This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thanks for joining us. We are here ready to discuss the important events of this past week with our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Good to be here.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
And from our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
From our office in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Greetings.
After an especially tense period between America and North Korea this past year, for a moment it looked like Kim Jong-un had turned over a new olive leaf, that peace with North Korea was possible. But this week, those hopes were put on ice. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah.
Yeah, that's right. It looks like the reason why all those peace offerings that we've seen North Korea make over the last month, the reason why they seemed too good to be true was because they were. You know, just a month ago, North Korean Supreme Leader Kim Jong-un visited the South. He agreed to formally end the Korean War by the end of the year. He committed to complete denuclearization of the North with no strings attached. And he requested a meeting with U.S. President Donald Trump about reforming North Korea. He even released some U.S. prisoners that he had in one of his evil camps there, just as sort of a sign of goodwill. And It all looked like Kim was truly committed to peace, but now he's back to behaving like a normal North Korean leader once again. Earlier this week, he withdrew from a planned follow-up meeting with South Korea, and then he just issued a series of insults about the U.S. leadership, and he even threatened a nuclear showdown with America. And over the last few days, he did apparently go ahead with plans to collapse parts of the North's nuclear testing site, but that move was neither irreversible nor was it really denuclearization. So it was just sort of an empty display. So it really does look like what had looked only weeks ago like an amazing achievement of U.S. diplomacy suddenly looks like business as usual for Pyongyang. And then yesterday, this all culminated in the cancellation by U.S. President Donald Trump of the meeting that he had planned with Kim for June 12th. So the meeting's off, and tensions are once again rising.
So the big question, and I don't know if anybody can answer this definitively, but we're getting a little bit of whiplash keeping up with the way that Kim Jong-un is handling his business here. Why would he have done what he did, and why the sudden turnaround now?
Well, Kim says the reason why he withdrew from this week's meeting with the South was because of the joint Air Force exercises that are underway right now between the U.S. and South Korea. That's the Max Thunder 2018 exercises. But it's really not hard to see that that's a false reason. You know, back in April, when Kim was very apparently devoted to peace, the U.S. and South Korea were holding two other annual joint military events. And Kim never issued any objection to those at all. They didn't hinder his visit to the South at that time. I don't think he even mentioned those when he was planting trees with Moon Jae-in there in South Korea. And this Max Thunder drill that's now underway is only an extension of those two previous exercises. It was scheduled well in advance. It was well known to all parties. So it's clear that this drill is not Kim's true reason for suddenly getting cold feet, even though that's what he says his reason is. And you're right that we can't say with definity what's actually going on in his mind, but it really looks like the reason for his return to hostility is China. If we remember back to March 25th, that was just before Kim's outreach to Seoul and Washington. And on that day, he made a surprise visit to Beijing. It was his very first foreign trip anywhere since he has been supreme leader, since coming into office in 2011. And it was only after that meeting with Chinese President Xi Jinping that Kim began offering olive branches to America and the South. And so analysts at that time really thought that Xi Jinping, probably as a result of American insistence, had encouraged Kim to make those reforms. And it seemed like she may have been just kind of rattled by President Trump's threats of trade war, which were being issued at that time. And it seemed like she was willing to revoke his backing of the North in hopes of just clinching a favorable trade deal with Washington. And then it's also important to know that on May 8th, just before Kim's big reversal and his retracting of all those, you know, peace offerings, he traveled to China for a second time and met with Xi Jinping again. So we don't know what happened in those meetings, but it seems beyond coincidence that we see these drastic changes in behavior happening just after he meets with, you know, the country that really keeps his regime afloat. So it looks like Xi may have never really intended for Kim to follow through on those promises of peace.
Essentially, what we're looking at here is exactly what Gerald Flurry has been saying for quite a long time, that North Korea is a distraction, that the real power that we need to keep our eyes focused on is China.
Yes, that's right. It really looks like, you know, China is just trying to kind of prolong the ambiguity and the confusion. Xi Jinping there is probably just using North Korea's oscillations between charm and threats to kind of distract the Trump administration for as long as possible. That way China is able to continue its build up there in the South China Sea and carry on with its other revisionist behaviors. And Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry has spoken directly about this. On September 13th of last year, he said the world should be considerably more concerned about Russia and China than about North Korea, because it's those two nations that are the ones that are really enabling Kim's regime and all of the duplicity and the belligerence that comes from North Korea. Mr. Flurry at that time wrote, "The Bible's prophecies show that, in a sense, the North Korean crisis is a massive distraction from the real threat posed by China and Russia. These powerful Asian nations are the only reason North Korea is able to operate so freely, and Bible prophecy shows that they pose a threat many times greater than the one from North Korea." And the prophecies that Mr. Flurry is referring to there are recorded in Ezekiel chapters 38 and 39, Daniel 11, Revelation, places like that. And these passages show that in the end time, there will be a powerful Asian bloc that ends up playing a big role in nuclear World War III, but it won't be led by North Korea. It'll be led by Russia and China. And we have a really in-depth trend article called "Why the Trumpet Watches the Rise of China as a Superpower." And it really goes through a lot of these prophecies and just shows where these tensions on the Korean Peninsula are leading. And it shows the hope and the inspiration that's ultimately tied to all this. So we'll have a link to that in our show notes.
Very good. Thank you for that, Jeremiah. Iran has been battling against Israel for years, but it has done so through proxies, through terrorist groups, using indirect means of warfare. But these past 3 months, we've seen a shift to more direct confrontation. And there are a lot of headlines that show how this is really turning into a regular occurrence. For this story, we're going to turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, it was last Thursday night, not this past Thursday night, but the one before, when Iran launched 32 missiles into Israel, and Israel had that really overwhelming response, spending many hours in the air with some F-35s, new airplane, and taking out 50 Iranian installations inside Syria. And since that time, and even a bit before then, we have just seen Israel step up a lot of its retaliatory strikes against Iran in Syria and in Lebanon, well, their proxies in Lebanon and Syria and directly in Syria. And another one that took place just last night, this was Israeli jets firing on a arms depot. This was belonging to Hezbollah inside Syria by Homs. And I forget how many were killed, just under 10 people were killed. But again, this is just becoming a very regular thing. This wasn't the only one this past week. There's numerous attacks taking place per week by Israel on Iranian forces themselves or Iranian-backed forces.
Right, and more evidence this week of just how tense the situation is getting. This story coming out about Benjamin Netanyahu kind of creating his underground war rooms.
Yeah, he will no longer be meeting with his security cabinet in the Prime Minister's office. That's what used to happen. That's not going to happen anymore. It is in a secure location underground. They've already had three meetings with the security cabinet underground. There's a number of reasons why he's probably doing this. One, it is because this underground bunker is nuclear missile proof. It is, you cannot penetrate it. But also because a lot of the Israeli media expect there to be some very sensitive discussions taking place here in the near future as to what to do about Iran more long term. And the Prime Minister does not want this type of information getting out, leaked to the media. How it could have happened before is somebody could be in the security meeting and then pop out of the office and go and make a phone call, and that it can be really quick that this type of sensitive information can be leaked. The Prime Minister doesn't want that to happen because of the tense times that he's in, and so his war room now is underground, reminiscent of, you know, World War II times, that type of thing.
Right. So this is quite an extraordinary change in strategy, it seems, for Iran, and Israel is having to take quite extreme measures to defend itself against this. But so much of the work that it has done for so long has been through these other groups. Even this week, I guess, we had the Hamas come out and say that he was very appreciative of the help that Iran has given and showing these strong ties. Well, maybe you could just talk about that a bit, just how much Iran has used these other groups as instruments of its own foreign policy.
Yeah, it's something that people need to realize is that it was a more of a covert type of action. I mean, Iran's connections to Hezbollah, they didn't really talk about them too much until the past probably decade when it was absolutely so obvious. And then even Hamas, they haven't been so outwardly. Hamas is the terrorist group that rules over the Gaza Strip here in southern Israel. They haven't been that overt with just crediting Iran for their existence. And now it seems that it is all out in the open. There is a war between Iran and Israel, and Iran has all these proxies it can mobilize. And even Hamas, the leader in the Gaza Strip, Yehiwa Sinwa, he came out this week, and this is on Monday, and he said this is on television, it was translated by memory, and he said that Hamas has greatly developed its capabilities thanks to friends, first and foremost the Islamic Republic of Iran, which was giving a lot of money, equipment, and expertise. And then he said, we have excellent relations with our brothers in Hezbollah. Our relations with them are extremely developed. We work closely together. We work together and coordinate and are in touch on an almost daily basis. Their relations are at the best stage ever. Now, people think Hezbollah, Hamas, they're natural allies, when, yes, they have been supported by Iran, but they are from opposite ends of the religious spectrum. One's a Sunni group, one's a Shiite group. And so their relationship hasn't been that good in the past. Now, they're in contact, you know, almost daily. And then he said this, Yehiwa Sinwar, again, the leader of Hamas in the Gaza Strip, quote, similarly, our ties with the Islamic Republic of Iran, with brother Qassam Soleimani and our other brothers in the IRGC leadership are very strong, powerful, and warm. And so what we've got here, the IRGC, this is the Ayatollah's personal force that he can direct anywhere in the Middle East, at least the Quds force, to further his goals. And he's saying here in Hamas that we have a strong relationship with the leader of that IRGC, Qassam Soleimani. He's our brother, just like Hezbollah calls him his brother. And so you have this situation developing where you've got proxies, but they're outward and outspoken with their support from Iran, and they're taking cues and direction directly from the IRGC leadership now.
Yeah,
and that kind of thing just has not happened in the past years.
And even for this leader to come out and say that so publicly is quite extraordinary. And it really wasn't that long ago that we saw somewhat of a rift between Hamas and Iran. There was a while there where it seemed that relationship was somewhat on the rocks, but it's come on full force, and these kinds of statements and then these direct attacks by Iran against Israel. What do you suppose is motivating the change? Certainly a very provocative foreign policy on Iran's part.
I think you know, what motivates Iran is domination. I think that's very obvious to most people now. Even another report came out this week that even through the nuclear deal, they were developing ballistic missiles in a secret site. The New York Times broke that. And so it's becoming more obvious to everybody that Iran does have goals to conquer other nations, something that is hard for our Western minds to think about and contemplate, that other leaders and nations have those type of goals. And Iran's becoming very open with it. And I'm going to mobilize my forces in Syria, same in Lebanon, same in the Gaza Strip. And I think just people should be really looking at this as seeing it Iran versus Israel type of battle right now. Yes, we hear about Hamas, but don't disconnect Iran's connection to Hamas. Hamas isn't. Hamas is saying, we take our orders from them. Yep. They're our brothers. And so we need to zoom out and see the bigger picture here when we see 60 Hamas or 50 Hamas members killed on the border of Gaza like they were a couple of weeks ago because of this march of return. That's from Iran.
Yep.
It's another front in the Iranian war against Israel. And that's the situation we have now in the Middle East.
Well, in a way, this is really a manifestation of what Gerald Fleury has been talking about for about two decades, and maybe even longer than that, that Iran really is the king of the king of the South, and all of these other groups that tend to absorb a lot of headlines and get a lot of attention. They really are taking their orders from Iran. Iran is the one that's driving the situation, and it's a manifestation of that reality that's been there for quite a long time. But as you said, there are a lot of people who have not owned up to that reality. But it does definitely seem like Iran is seizing the moment and being more more upfront with its goals and ambitions. If you had to point someone to more information, where would you send them to, Brent?
Yeah, to get the big picture on this, just a classic article by our editor-in-chief, Why You Must Watch Jerusalem. It talks about Iran's connection to its desires for Jerusalem. It talks about the fight Israel has on its hands, and it shows you where that is leading in Bible prophecy. As you said, for two decades, Mr. Fleury's talked about Iran's goals in the Middle East, to be that king of the South, and that article really does bring all the pieces together for our listeners.
Thanks for that, Brent. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our Week in Review program on 101.3 KPCG. After U.S. President Donald Trump broke from the nuclear deal with Iran, European nations were quite upset. And this week, we got a bit of an idea of how they're going to handle the resulting rift with America. For this story, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes, it's been very interesting to see exactly who European leaders have been meeting with and what they've been doing in the wake of this nuclear deal. Because really, this deal poses Europe a problem that goes far beyond just the immediate situation in Iran. All of Europe's security arrangements, its entire arrangements of alliances, its place in the world is kind of predicated on this alliance with the United States. And the Iran nuclear deal, the breakover of the Iran nuclear deal, is the latest in a series of events that places a lot of question on those alliances. And really, for decades, you know, America has done a huge amount of heavy lifting on Europe's behalf, acting in a lot of ways in Europe's interest instead of in its own interest. You know, in Yugoslavia or in the Middle East, you know, when Europe wants something taken care of, America does it for them. And so what we're seeing is the end of that era. And so Europe's, okay, well, we've got to take care of ourselves. We've got to look after our own interests. What do we do? Where do we go? So almost immediately, German Chancellor Angela Merkel goes to see Vladimir Putin. She visited with him in Sochi last week. And then this week, you had Angela Merkel yesterday arriving in Beijing. And it was really interesting. You had her, she arrived in Beijing. Her foreign minister was meeting with U.S. officials in America on the same day, and it was quite the contrast in receptions. You know, much more frosty reception in Berlin, whereas Beijing, I mean, in the U.S., in Washington, Beijing rolled out the red carpet for Ms. Merkel, and it was a very warm and friendly meeting. Then you had Emmanuel Macron. He played his visits now to Putin, and he was there yesterday, and he was you know, they called it bouquet diplomacy. Vladimir Putin then gave Macron's wife of some flowers. And again, it was all lots of friendly optics. So you're seeing these nations turn to and immediately start meeting with Russia and China. There are more substantial moves as well. Most of them revolve around this Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline that will run from Germany, from Russia to Germany. This will allow Russia to cut off natural gas to Eastern European nations without having to cut off their more lucrative customers in Western Europe at the same time. So it turns Russia's natural gas weapon into a much more of a precision tool. At the same time, it gives Germany access to cheaper gas for its export machine, and it gives it it makes it Germany kind of this sub hub for Russian energy in Europe. And so Angela Merkel and Vladimir Putin, they agreed to push forward in that on their meeting in Sochi. At the same time, yesterday, the European Commission, they had been investigating Gazprom for various illegalities, for breaking European law. They raided Gazprom's offices. They were building to this showdown. And then yesterday, surprisingly, Europe's antitrust commissioner said, there's no fines whatsoever for Gazprom for any of these past actions, because even though they did bad stuff in the past, they've completely changed. Russia's a good guy now.
Well,
but Gazprom is apparently completely mending its ways. No evidence at all for this, but they've agreed to play by the rules. Europe's going to pursue this no further. So some kind of significant turnarounds there. Then you're seeing Europe. Well, and you're seeing Europe. What's most notable about this is Germany. The U.S. is trying to make Europe choose between the U.S. and Russia. They're threatening. They're saying if you move forward with this Nord Stream 2, we're going to put American sanctions on any European companies involved in this project. And you see immediately in response to that, Europe doubling down on Nord Stream 2. So with this flurry of visits and announcements and things in the wake of the Iran deal being broken up, you see a Europe that is looking much more to Russia and much more to China.
Anyone who's followed the trumpet for a long time has to be looking at this with alarm bells ringing in our ears. We've been talking for a long time about particularly, well, I guess you're looking at really two different, somewhat related trends here. But the relationship between Germany and Russia is one that, historically speaking, has been a precursor to major warfare on multiple occasions. But then you also have this prophesied relationship between Europe and Asia, bringing China into that mix that shows, I mean, we're really talking about a pretty strong move by Europeans away from an alliance with the United States and looking toward Asia. Putting it in prophetic context, we can see just how significant this is, and also that this is not something that would be a long-term arrangement, but it's more a matter of the kind of the convenience of the moment setting up these kinds of relationships in the short term.
I think anybody who's been studying geopolitics for a long time would be very much disturbed by these developments. I mean, you can go back 100 years and look at geopolitical thinkers like Halford Mackinder. But basically, just about anybody thinking a lot about security and America's place in the world for the last century has been warning. What America wants to prevent is a Eurasian alliance, a conglomeration of nations on the continent of Eurasia that are working together against the United States, because there's just a huge amount of resource and power there. And yeah, what you're seeing now is almost the entire rest of the world starting to coalesce against the United States. And just the knowledge of history, like you mentioned, with the history of Europe and Russia shows that is a bad thing. But the Bible also talks about this alliance. It talks about, well, Herbert W. Armstrong was writing for decades about what is building between Germany. I mean, the 1962 Plain Truth between Germany and Russia wrote, "Once a German-dominated Europe is fully established, Germany will be ready to negotiate and bargain with Russia and behind the backs of Western allies if necessary. When a Russo-German deal is made, you can be sure that the doom of the United States and Great Britain is on the horizon. And then Isaiah 23 talks about
that was May 1962, the plain truth said
that. That's right.
Yeah, that's extraordinary.
Decades. But this was what people worried about during the Cold War, was Europe turning to Russia. There was a lot of talk during the Cold War with scholars worrying about that, and that's what we see happening now. But Isaiah 23 talks about the same thing. It describes, you know, there's so much news on Isaiah 23, we seem like we mention it every week on this show. But it's a prophecy there about a trading bloc, about a trading relationship that includes Europe, that includes China, that includes Japan. Bible prophecy also mentions China and Japan allying with Russia, so it would imply that Russia would be involved in that. I mean, Russia's not a great international trading nation, which is probably why it's not mentioned by name there. But you have this conglomeration of nations coming together economically, and then you have other scriptures talking about an economic siege against the United States. And so that's what you see building with headlines like this from Deutsche Welle. Is Germany courting China and abandoning the U.S.? That's what we've been writing for several years based on this prophecy in Isaiah 23. So definitely something to keep watching, something that the Bible has talked about a long time in advance. Trumpet.com managing editor Brad McDonald, he had an article about a year ago called Trade Wars Have Begun. It was the cover issue of our April 2017 Trumpet edition. That's a great place to start just to get an introduction to that book, the Mart of Nations prophecy in Isaiah 23 that talks about this trade alliance. So you can get a great overview of that there. And you can get more detail on that in Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry's book, Isaiah's End Time Vision. And that talks about what is prophesied there, what is prophesied for the United States. And, you know, even now there are geopoliticians sounding some pretty dire warnings about what this is leading to. And that booklet, Isaiah's End Time Vision, will give you the hope for what happens beyond that crisis that this is leading to as well.
And on top of that, Richard has an article that's up on the Trumpet site. It was put up there yesterday. It's called When Germans Worry, Where Do They Turn? Go check that out. There's a lot of information there and some links to other relevant material that you can find. All the links to all of these you can find on the Trumpet Hub for the Trumpet Hour. This is on thetrumpet.com. Well, I feel like I'm saying trumpet a lot right now, but on the trumpet.com, go check it out. This show will put links to all of these relevant articles and booklets for you to click on. We appreciate that, Richard. This is Trumpet Hour on 101.3 KPCG on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Stephen Fleury has been covering a lot of the ins and outs of the investigations and scandals plaguing America's government these days. If you're looking for evidence of just how irrationally anti-Trump the left is, look no further than the fact that you now have the New York Times and Washington Post coming to the point where they're defending the government spying on innocent American citizens. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yes, the media response to this is, I think, one of the most interesting angles of this story. Now, we covered a little bit on this program last week about allegations that a British mole had infiltrated the Trump campaign to spy for the Obama administration. And now this week it turns out that I guess the so-called British mole was actually an American professor working and living in Britain, working for Cambridge University. And his father-in-law had worked for the CIA, and he'd been paid about $1 million over the course of Obama's second term doing various information gathering projects for the Defense Department. This professor had met with several people in the Trump campaign just to try to collect information on the so-called Russia collusion scandal that he could report back to the FBI in. And I read one story in the Washington Post just making sure that this is really an event with enormous consequences. It's a possibly unprecedented in American history to have the incumbent political party targeting the candidate for the opposition party. And trying to tilt an election that way. So, like I said, they're accusing the Trump campaign of colluding with Russia. But no, this is definite evidence that the Clinton campaign was colluding with America's intelligence agencies to influence the outcome of an election. And now getting back to the point we made at the beginning, it is shocking is that for most of American history, news outlets like the New York Times and the Washington Post have been extremely anti-spying. When the George Bush administration started using some wiretapping techniques, even on foreign terrorists, these two news media sources really came out with what a assault on liberty and freedom in the United States that was for governments to take that type of power.
Which that's what you would expect.
Which is what you'd expect. I mean, a lot of conservative outlets took the same stance. Those were not popular programs. Mm-hmm. But now they're using some of those programs to they're not to target terrorists, but to target a Republican presidential candidate. They're all for it. Coming out, the New York Times had the one headline that it wasn't a spy, it was an informant, which kind of just shows how desperately grasping at straws they are trying to put a veneer over what the Obama administration has done there. It's like, so it wasn't a spy in the Trump campaign. It was a government informant in a Trump campaign. And I guess he's got to open the thesaurus somewhere on some journalist's desk because it's trying to look for benign sounding synonyms. But
yeah,
this is and even James Clapper, who he works for CNN as a security analyst now, but he was the director of national intelligence under Barack Obama, had come out and he said, well, he's like, there's no proof there was a spy in the Trump campaign yet, but if there does come out that there was, it's definitely really, really good thing that the government was keeping tabs on that situation.
Right.
Which doesn't give you a lot of confidence on the no proof thing. I'm like, you were director of national intelligence at the time. I'm pretty sure you know what happened.
Right.
Didn't happen.
Well, actually, it's a good thing that it happened.
Right. So now they're coming out. And that's actually in his case, that's actually kind of a really good example of someone who was the director of national intelligence, now working for a media agency. Mm-hmm. That's defending what the national intelligence agencies did.
Yeah.
So just showing that it went from having these liberal left-wing news outlets being absolutely opposed to all forms of government spying to actually hiring the director of aforesaid spy agency to defend how great government spying is.
Yeah, that's absolutely extraordinary. So it definitely shows a whole lot of ideological alignment between the two.
Yes, there's definitely a lot of ideological alignment between the two, as you said. And it does really show a disturbing trend in American politics that's gotten much worse over the past several years of putting party above country or even party above principle, to where this isn't actually about one political party being for government spying and another political party being against government spying. It's all about, well, if you're using government power to spy on foreign terrorists, that's bad. If you're using government power to spy on a Republican presidential campaign we don't like, that's great. And it's got like this tribal spirit that is very dangerous because, I mean, we haven't seen anything quite like it since the Reconstruction era, just after the Civil War, and 600,000 people died in that tribal fight.
Mm-hmm.
And America's heading in a similar direction where you, especially in the case of the radical left, that you actually hate the opposition political party more than you even hate America's foreign enemies.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just leading to just all like this division and backfighting that's tearing the country apart. This is actually something in the Bible in Isaiah 3 that's prophesied, where the beginning part of that chapter talks about how because of the sins of the people, God will take away the great leaders, the men of war and the eloquent orator, and then all these leaders. But when those leaders are taken away, by the time you get to Isaiah 3 and verse 5, it says, "And then the people shall be oppressed, every one by another, and every one by his neighbor. The child shall behave himself proudly against the ancient, and the base against the honorable." And so the end part of that verse is focusing more on rebellious children. But the beginning part of the perk is like definitely like every man against another, every man against his neighbor, brother against brother. It's talking about like the type of things you would have seen in America's first civil war, where you had families ripped apart with one person fighting for one side and one person fighting for another side. And you're seeing the same thing now, where you've got families and communities where you've got political differences, to where they're the ones from the one political party, they're putting their party up so high up in that empirical self-tribal loyalty that they're actually even willing to like trash the Constitution and flip-flop on their previous principles, or just do whatever it takes to win without actually thinking about, well, what is the end result of empowering a spy agency to tip the results and rig not just foreign elections, but actually rig your own elections.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very, very well put. We appreciate that, Andrew. If you want more information about that, I would encourage you to pay attention to what Stephen Fleury has been talking about on the Trumpet Daily radio show. He's also written up a major article that is part of a package of articles on the cover of our next Trumpet edition. This is the July 2018 Philadelphia Trumpet. You can find that online. The title of his article is "The U.S. Government is at War with Itself." We also have Andrew's article, "The Deep State, Is It Real?" And an article by Gerald Fleury about a warning from America's greatest past presidents. There's a lot in that issue on this very important, very prophetically relevant subject. So go check that out. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. We're going to take a short break. Coming up, we'll talk about some bold authoritarian moves from the presidents of Turkey and Russia, and Sweden preparing itself for an invasion from Russia, and that and more. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
A couple stories here about rising authoritarianism. The first from Turkey, a move by the strongman president of that country. For this, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
So as part of these rules or laws that have been changing inside Turkey as a result of the attempted coup back in 2016, is Erdogan is taking more power to himself. We've talked about that a lot in the program. But the latest move is that he is creating his own special forces unit that reports directly to him. Of course, he has had staff that report to him before in the military sense. But now that is going to grow substantially. By the end of this year, this force that is going to that is mainly made up of special police, or basically special forces, is going to total somewhere around 50,000 people. And so this is going to give Erdogan a lot of control, especially considering how the military in Turkey has been the force that has stopped authoritarians clinging to power, or stopped even the bend towards Islamicization inside Turkey. They have put a stop to that. And now we have the gutting of the military, high command of the military in the aftermath of the coup. About half of the high military officials have been sacked. And on the other side, we've got this special police force going to report directly to Erdogan, kind of the likes of how the IRGC reports directly the Iranian special forces, or their force reports directly to the Ayatollah. Erdogan wants that. Erdogan sees that that's important for him to have to maintain his power over the nation. And so by the end of the year, 50,000 men aren't going to be a part of another command structure. They're going to be answering directly to his will.
That is a huge personal army. Iran is a good corollary that you described. It seems that Vladimir Putin did something similar to that in Russia. Didn't he do that?
Yes, that's right. Back in April of 2016, he made the National Guard answer only to himself. So This is a force of about 180,000 soldiers, and they answer exclusively to Putin now. So it's really a safeguard against potential coups and things like that.
This is, you could say, a major nail in the coffin of hopes that Turkey would actually turn around. I just talking with the the editor-in-chief of Zaman recently. He was expressing a certain amount of optimism that that things would turn around. I don't know how much that is what that's based on exactly, but Erdogan is actually having this election next month that should cement some of his powers. The fact that he's making this move and creating this special gendarmerie at this point, does that factor into that? It seemed like there were some indications that he might there might be some factors working against him.
Yeah, that's interesting. It you could look at this two ways. One, he realizes that he might not win this election, and so he's going to ensure that he has the force to ensure that he does win it by whatever means. Elections aren't very free and fair in Turkey, at least the last couple haven't been, and so maybe he is going to use this force in that way. Or maybe it's a sign that he feels that his popularity is so big, is enough already, that he can do such outlandish things as this in bringing 50,000 men under his wing, and he's still confident that he can win the election.
Well, let's just go ahead and move on to the second story that we have along these lines about authoritarianism within Vladimir Putin's Russia. For this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, last week, Putin commemorated the opening of the Crimean Bridge. So this is it's just a very impressive feat of engineering that Russians and other powers have wanted to build for hundreds of years, and now Putin has done it. This bridge spans the Strait of Kerch, which is right there between mainland Russia and the Crimean Peninsula. It contains more steel than would be in 32 Eiffel Towers.
Wow.
And at almost 12 miles long, it's not just Russia's longest bridge, but now the longest in all of Europe. So it's a really remarkable accomplishment there. And Putin completed this in less than 4 years, while under very intense sanctions and in clear and unapologetic violation of international law. So that's, that violation is because the Crimean Peninsula was part of Ukraine's sovereign territory up until 2014, when Putin's forces unlawfully seized it. And then they've wasted very little time connecting it to Mother Russia with this bridge.
So this really is quite a symbol of just how much he's cementing this victory that that took place, I guess, when he when did you say he
March of 2014 is when the annexation really happened.
So yeah, this really is a cementing what he accomplished in March of 2014 with Crimea, and quite a bold move just in the face of all of those who were against it. There's not really much slowing him down these days.
Yeah, that's right. You know, many in the West still maintain that Crimea is a part of Ukraine. They say it still belongs to Ukraine. It's still their territory. But this bridge cements Putin's rule of that territory. And it just shows how meaningless this kind of rhetoric from the West is. It shows how meaningless international law has become in this era of declining American power and just rising authoritarianism. Yeah. If you have the power, you do what you're going to do, despite what people may, you know, say and argue about.
So this is obviously these two stories, one about Erdogan, the other about Putin. These really do illustrate this point that we've been making for quite some time at the Trumpet, just how we are entering and really in some ways quite deep into this age of authoritarianism, the decline in more democratic governments and the rise in more authoritarian governments. Our January 2018 cover, King Me, The Rise of Strongmen Heralds a Dangerous New Era. You should go check that out. We had stories about Putin and Erdogan in that edition. Any additional information that you would point people to, Brent?
Well, yeah, I think the lead article in that issue was by Mr. Stephen Fleury, and it's entitled The New Strongmen Age, and it puts all these leaders or authoritarians together and zooms out, and you can take a look at the big picture and how the Bible really does talk about kings, princes, leaders like that. And we are seeing that type of thing in the leaders that we've mentioned on today's program.
Any additional thoughts, Jeremiah?
Well, there's one other article that just informs this same trend and just shows how this is fulfilling Bible prophecy, and that is Mr. Gerald Fleury, our editor-in-chief. He wrote an article called What Are the Times of the Gentiles? And he specifically talked about men like Vladimir Putin and just how this shows that the world is entering into a sobering new age in which might makes right.
Thank you very much for that, gentlemen. With Vladimir Putin making these kinds of moves, folks in Europe are understandably concerned. To look at an example of this from Sweden, we'll go back to Britain and hear from Richard Palmer.
Sweden's government has given a really remarkable pamphlet to all of its householders. The pamphlet is called If Crisis or War Comes. It has headings like, if Sweden is attacked, resistance is required. And what I think is really remarkable about this is they haven't been handing these leaflets out since 1961, at least not to householders. They handed them out to local government offices. They stopped doing that in 1991. So this is after several decades of not doing this, they've suddenly decided, the world is a really dangerous place. We need to start getting our people ready for this. I'll read you another few quotes from this pamphlet. It says, for many years, the preparations made in Sweden for the threat of war have been very limited. However, it says, as the world around us has changed, the government has decided to strengthen Sweden's total defense. That is why planning for Sweden's civil defense has been resumed. And it has, it exhorts citizens, if Sweden is attacked by another country, we will never give up. All information to the effect that resistance is to cease is false. It contains all kinds of practical information about how to recognize different types of warning sirens. Is it an air raid siren? Is it a different emergency siren? Where to go to take shelters from bombs? What type of food stuff and things like that to keep on hand in your house so that you're prepared in case of an emergency? So really quite a remarkable booklet to be giving out to the entire country.
Yeah, this just brings my mind right back to that cover story in 2004. Gerald Fleury wrote, Russia Frightens Europe and Fulfills Bible Prophecy, where he specifically talked about just how much, and this is something that we've followed up on quite a bit over the years, just how much Europe and Eastern Europe in particular is looking at what's happening over there in Russia and is really quite concerned about it. And this could actually help to fulfill some of the most important prophecies in the Bible.
That's right. Now, Russia isn't mentioned specifically in this document, and it does mention terrorism specifically a few times. And I think the large migrant populations within Sweden and the threat of terrorism is definitely a factor here as well. So they do have other things in mind. But yeah, you look at the threat Sweden is facing, and it's quite clear that Russia is a big part of the reason why they're more concerned than ever. Russia is the one that has been sending planes into Sweden's airspace. Russia is the one that's been sending submarines into Sweden's waters. Russia is the one that's been behind cyber attacks, which do get several mentions in this article or in this pamphlet. But Russia's been the one behind launching cyber attacks against Sweden. Of course, Russia is the one that invaded Crimea, like we just heard about, that has been making other nations in Eastern Europe nervous. I mean, if you look at why is Sweden after since 1961 warning its citizens, well, Russia is the very clear reason.
So, Richard, you're working on an article about this that should appear in the next couple of days or so. Anything that you would direct people to in the meantime?
Yeah, so that 2004 article you mentioned, Russia Frightens Europe and Fulfills Bible Prophecy, is a great place to start. That will go through some of the prophecies. And there are scriptures like Daniel chapter 11, verse 40 to 43, that talk specifically about Europe getting nervous because of tidings out of the east, because of things going on in Russia. And you can see trends leading to that building already today. Then also we have our free booklet, The Prophesied Prince of Rosh, and that is really a fantastic place to start to understand what is going on in Russia, the rise of this strongman in Russia that we've already heard somewhat about, and how that is going to impact Europe.
All right, thanks very much, Richard. Our final story, the United States has one of the highest incarceration rates in the world. And there are people who would suggest that it's because of overzealous policing, too stringent drug laws, racial profiling, racist law enforcement. Well, are any of those the actual reason for this? To answer this question, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, the incarceration rate has been in the news a bit this week. It's actually come down a bit over the past two decades, from a full 1% of the U.S. population being behind bars to only about 0.8%. That's only in certain states, where it's coming from about 30 states, it's come down, 20 states, it's gone up. But just taking a bigger overview, whether it's down or up, it is still higher than pretty much any other Western nation, and by some counts, it's actually higher than any nation except for maybe North Korea. And so that does just raise the interesting question is, like, what is wrong with America's prison population? And there was a CityLab article by Heather McDonald this week that really breaks down a lot of those statistics and showing that America doesn't, well, in her words, it says America doesn't necessarily have an incarceration problem as it does a crime problem. And I'm not necessarily here to defend any and every incarceration policy the American government has put together. But when you do look at the statistics, it's undeniable that the reason that America's got one of the highest incarceration rates in the world is it has one of the biggest crime problems in the world. American streets may seem quite a bit safer than some places in Latin America, but that's because a lot of those people are behind bars here. Mm-hmm. And even back in 1956, our founder of the Plain Truth magazine, Herbert W. Armstrong, had written some about this, and the problem was much less worse then, but kind of making the same point that this this huge prison population is a sign of just how bad crime has gotten in the United States. And he even in that article drew parallels to like the fall of Rome with like rising criminal activity being one of the things that Edward Gibbons wrote in his famous book on one of the reasons the Roman Empire fell, is just the breakdown of the rule of law and this rising crime problem, which is something that's much more developed in the United States than it is in most European nations. And just really a huge problem the nation grapples with. And to have a verse I've brought in here from Hosea 4, the first three verses of Hosea 4, actually, that talks about this, where it says, "Hear the word of the Lord, you children of Israel, for the Lord has a controversy with the inhabitants of the land, because there is no truth, nor mercy, nor knowledge of God in the land. By swearing and lying and killing and stealing and committing adultery, they break out, and blood touches blood." It's a pretty sobering verse that described ancient Israel just before it fell. It describes America today, and it really gets at the root cause of America's incarceration problems. It says, because there is no knowledge of God in the land, people lie and they kill and they steal and they commit adultery, and those crimes end many of them up in the prison system.
Mm-hmm. Well, very interesting. Maybe we can have a longer discussion on that point when we've got a little bit more time. There's definitely a lot there to talk about. I'm Joel Hilliker. That'll actually do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com for links to all the articles and the literature that we discussed today. You can email your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Great to be here.
It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Arthur Hopkins. "There is a wealth of unexpressed love in the world. It's one of the chief causes of sorrow evoked by death. What might have been said or what might have been done that never can be said or done." Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world. We'll be right back.